Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati, our first of the year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. I'm here with my co-host, Burl Love, and soon to be joining us, first guest of the year.
Wow, I didn't think about that. The first guest of the year. That'll be a good trivia question later on. Who is the first guest of the That's So Cincinnati podcast in 2024? And it will be...
New Cincinnati Fire Chief Frank McKinley. He's about 100 days in. I asked him on day one if he'd be on the podcast, and everyone was like, give him a second, Sherry. But I'm type A, so I kept asking, and here we are. I'm excited to talk just a little bit about who he is. He's getting some good early reviews from
some
of the...
He's got a fascinating background I want to get into when we chat with him, so that'll be good.
So, yeah.
But, you know, we've taken a little break over the holidays, and, you know, the news did not stop. Do you want to start with a pretty significant, although totally expected and anticipated, but we had the reporting to prison by P.G. Sittenfeld this week.
We did, and he did it very quietly. You know, he had asked, he was sentenced back in November to spend 16 years. November, October, oh my goodness, the months are running together. But he was sentenced to spend 16 months in prison on two federal corruption charges. He had asked the federal appeals court if he could stay out during his appeal. Those do take a long time and likely longer than his actual sentence. The appeals court said no. We probably have talked about that on this podcast. So he did have a report date of January 2nd, and he did go. He went to Ashland Federal Correction Institution, and he did so very quietly. Let's face it, I asked for an interview, and I did not get one.
Not surprising.
I will say, I'm just going to say, if you know me, I've already talked about this with you. I do have a very serious job, as you all know. And in my personal life, I don't watch a lot of serious things. I watch lighthearted things. I don't watch a lot of TV to begin with. I read books.
You get enough reality, true crime.
Everything.
All of that in your day-to-day life.
So I do. I like light things. I like reality TV. I am 100% Italian, and when Jersey Shore came out, I was a huge fan of Jersey Shore. So I read a memoir over the holidays by one of the characters who went to, here's the segue, you guys. Sorry, that was a long way of getting to
even
that.
Even I am wondering, like, well, where are you going?
Here's the segue
where are you
to
going
that.
Here, Sherry?
One of the characters.
Not Snooki.
No, Mike, the situation, went to federal prison for tax evasion.
Okay.
And he went to a federal prison camp, much like PG is going to. And the entire book was a fascinating peek, reality TV, kind of peek behind the scenes, how he became a star and everything. The very last chapter is, what it's like at a federal prison camp. And I was like, I didn't see this coming, but here we are. And it was really an interesting kind of read in thinking about what PG's life is like right now. Because, you know, you hear like, oh, you know, federal country clubs, but no. And you know what? It's not a prison. It's not your typical, what you think of, you know, a cell door.
Locked up in a cell.
Slamming.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He just, from what I've seen about the prison where PG is, this seems like a very similar thing. You know, it's not, you're not looking at, you know, barbed wires and fences. You're at like what's called a camp. Everybody has a job. It's set in a very wooded area. But it's also not a walk in the park. He talked about... you know, you still, your life is guided by somebody else. You have to earn privileges. You do what you're told. There's counts several times a day. What he talked a little bit about, you know, there's just no privacy. You live in a room like 50 other people. Everybody's not maybe as hygienic as you. He's like, and he was with all white collar criminals, which is pretty much seems like the situation that PG Sittenfeld is in right now in this camp. And okay, so he's not, you know, sleeping next to somebody who killed somebody, but you do have the arguments with the people. There's like, everyone's not best friends,
right.
And it's, you know, you're not there with your friends.
Right.
It was, and he really very much described what was still a prison experience. He said one of the things that he was looking most forward to when he served an 8-month sentence was, a towel that wasn't wet, and not really from being dirty, but because there's just no time to dry all the towels and everything. Yeah. And he's just like, you know, he's like, it was prison. I was away from my family and it wasn't fun.
And in his own, you know, defense, that was a strong component about it. Do you want to remove somebody from his family? So that's tough. I mean, people can roll their eyes and call it a country club, but he's lost his freedom. I mean, he is going to be in that federal facility away from his family. And yeah, it's not Alcatraz, but it's definitely, you know, it's prison.
You know, I've written a lot about it, you know, and this is a person that I talk to pretty much every day of my life, as he was going to be the next mayor. That's not a joke. It's said in court papers. I've written it in stories. He was the leader on city council. And then one day I stopped talking to him after he was arrested.
Right.
It was a big shock.
Yeah.
And so I do know him. And I certainly on the second, you know, did not write about what was happening or anything, but I was thinking about the idea of having to leave your kids and your wife and do this.
Yeah. Well, the other big story, and we have to put it into context, it's really not a huge story in terms of long lasting impact. But it's the story that's got our readers and the community whipped up a little bit, at least in terms of letters to the editor and people wanting to submit guest columns and think comments on social media and all of that. And that is the mourning of the loss of Coney Island, which it was announced, you know, as we were heading into the holiday season that it was shutting down. It wouldn't be opening next year, and that it was sold to MEMI, which is the company that manages it. What's it stand for? Music Entertainment Management, Inc., something like that?
Something like that.
Yes. I just call it MEMI. But you know MEMI as the apparatus of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra that manages a lot of entertainment venues in town, including the Brady Center, Riverbend. And that's where you see the a little bit of animosity thrown towards MEMI, because they hope to take that property, which they've purchased, and develop into what many are calling Riverbend 2.0, an expansion of that music venue and facility to something that will carry it into the future, attract larger and more types of acts. And let's face it, if you've been to Riverbend, it's been Riverbend in that format for a very long time.
It has, and it MEMI does have to like grow and change. But I think there's a lot of the story has not been told yet. And we're much like I'm sure everyone else is really trying to like tell like the bigger story about what's happening. They did make an announcement, you know, before Christmas. I think they had to that the pool was not going to be open, because it's right. Basically become like, you know, this big
right. Sun. And people because did have so season people, passes.
Right.
And planning
so people
and
didn't
like
buy
that.
Season
right.
passes mm-hmm. for Christmas. They didn't buy gift cards. What was going on? I think they had to say. So they said what was happening in a way that was like, well, we're not going to be open next season without really hearing what this bigger story is. The rides went away 5 years ago. They're very expensive to run, insure. I think this property was for sale, it seems like to me. And they were just a natural buyer. Anyone
sure.
could have but purchased it. It's not like they bought it and they're they came in and they're destroying, you know, everyone's memories. That's not the goal here. Things had really... It's a hard landscape to run.
And it's hard here. Those, you know, Cincinnati loves its traditions. And even though you might not have personally been to Coney or Sunlight Pool in 10, 12, 15 years, it feels like a punch in the gut to know that it's going to be gone. Like Americana, those of us who grew up here, there was a, you know, you've got Kings Island, right? That's the, you know, regional destination theme park here. But there used to be a handful of other small amusement parks. And that's just not the world we live in anymore.
No, because it's so expensive to insure rides and run a park like that. By the time you charge the ticket price for that, you're going to Kings Island. for like the bigger rides because it becomes so expensive to run a park like that. It's very expensive to run a pool like that.
Right. And the pool did have, you know, it's historic. It was the first, and I think it maintained the title of the largest recirculating swimming pool. So, you know, it has been fun to watch the debate on both sides.
I saw a honking wave. People were like, have a honking wave to save it. It's like,
oh yeah, there's petitions. There's petitions starting to save it and all of that. But you know, this is anytime you have quote unquote progress happening, there are going to be people who are sad to see elements of the past go. And I think everybody understands that. So that's, you know, in a lot of stories, you have the protagonist and the antagonist. You're looking for the victims and the victimizers and things like that. And I think I said in one of our news stories or our news planning meetings that, like, as much as people are looking for a villain here, there's really not. You know, this is just one of those moments in our history where we're going to say goodbye to something that was an institution that people had in their childhood memories. And I think we all understand that. But yes, it's been fascinating. And that's one of the things I like about our job and what we do as the Enquirer is that we provide that platform for people on both sides of an issue to weigh in, to share ideas. I always hope that if somebody reads a guest column or a letter to the editor, even if they vehemently disagree with it and say, how can you give this lunatic your platform, that maybe they just appreciate the perspective of somebody else. I mean, that's an important role that we have in connecting the community is providing that platform. And oh my, have people taken advantage of our platform on this issue. So I'm sure there'll be more to come.
I think it's the new railroad. Like, I know, there was right? like a million letters on the railroad.
How quickly
it's the
we
new
moved.
One, yeah.
I think that everybody involved in the railroad were happy for the Coney story to break because they're finally like, oh, thank goodness the spotlight's off of us right now. So anyway, well, speaking of spotlights, let's put the spotlight on the new fire chief, should we?
I like that idea.
All right.
Special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. I am so excited to welcome Cincinnati Fire Chief Frank McKinley. This is your first time on the podcast, which isn't a surprise because you're still kind of new. Right. But welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
So I feel like you're swearing in. October 7th was yesterday, but that's the end of the year, I guess, kind of squishes together. I'm guessing it's the same for you. Does it seem like 3 months?
Ooh, it's kind of all of a blur. There's so many things that we've been able to take a look at over the last 90 days, close to 90 days. And it's been real exciting and received a lot of support and a lot of feedback.
We did ask for you to be on, like, kind of right out of the gate. And the city administration was like, could you give him a second? I was like, I guess. So let's talk a little bit. You came from Dallas where you had, we don't like to age anybody on this show, where you did have a long distinguished career as accumulating in an assistant chief job there.
Yes.
What made you like really look at Cincinnati?
Well, Cincinnati is to me, a very beautiful city and it has a lot of character and a lot of tradition and has a lot of opportunity having the oldest professional fire department in the United States. And so it comes with that prestige. And when you come up through the system, like in Dallas, and I'm sure that you know a lot of the fire chiefs have recently gone to a lot of different cities. The fire chief in Orlando is from Dallas. The fire chief from Las Vegas is from Dallas. The fire chief from Arlington, Texas is from Dallas. And so, you know, we work together, but we look for opportunities a lot of times after we receive a lot of training, a lot of exposure to a lot of different aspects in the fire service. And so to be able to go apply them or incorporate them in other cities is a real privilege and an honor.
So you go through the process here. What's been like the biggest, you know, surprise from moving from Dallas to the Midwest?
Well, it's really, as far as the fire service is concerned, it's not a lot of difference in the sense that, you know, we were both fire-based EMS systems, and the way the city responds here is a little bit different as far as the equipment that is dispatched out to certain calls and things like that. And it's interesting, and having the opportunity to talk to a very, very knowledgeable command staff has really helped take a look at things and allowed us to try to focus in certain areas and aspects that we could possibly improve upon.
So I want to start off with, we'll get into the issues with the Cincinnati Fire Department, challenges and things like that. But I think it would be fun to start with the Frank McKinley story. And I'm fascinated because I think at some point in the life of every little kid, when they're asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? At some point you say, I want to be a fireman. But you actually are a firefighter, professional firefighter. Did you always want to be that? What was your path to becoming a fire chief?
Well, it is kind of interesting. When I was going into the ninth grade, I had an opportunity to visit Dallas, Texas, where my brother, William O'Neill, he was a driver engineer for the fire department. And so had an opportunity at a very young age to be exposed to it. And they actually had during that time, the Firefighter Olympics out there, where firefighters from all over the state would come. And it was a lot of camaraderie. It was a lot of sports. It was boxing. It was softball and things like that. But just kind of, you know, those type of things, and being able to go to the firehouse and see how the different things were accomplished and how they responded. And so I kept asking questions throughout my career. And so as I was approaching graduation in high school, I talked to my brother about, hey, what do I need to do? What do I need to major in to become a firefighter? And he recommended some things. But at the school I went to, I had a football scholarship, played at Mississippi College, ended up leaving Mississippi College, and played football at Delta State, where I graduated from. Neither of them had fire service programs, but I had the requirements to get on to Dallas. I actually lost my starting position at wide receiver at Delta State because I went to take the civil service test in Dallas during football season. So I missed a couple of days of practice, but it was well worth it. It was kind of a funny story.
You weren't headed to the NFL, is that?
But that, so then that was the funny part of it. So, you know, they started accepting applications again, and then I go into the head coach's office. Hey, I just got a call from Dallas. And he was like, the Cowboys? I was like, oh, the fire department. So, you know, it was as soon as I graduated from college, I drove all the way out. And in September of 1995, I started at the fire academy. And so I'm just super excited about the career, the opportunity, having the opportunity to work for a large city was something that I really wanted to do, and waited a while to actually promote. I was enjoying being a paramedic on the, we call them rescues, but they're ambulances in Dallas. And I really enjoyed that. And so promoted through the ranks, driver, I was a lieutenant. I started teaching at once I became a fire instructor, I started teaching at a couple of community colleges. And I ended up teaching at TEKS, Texas A&M Engineering Extension Service, where I'm still acting adjunct down there. So I just fell in love with the fire service. And so I continued to promote and have an opportunity to become the deputy chief of training down there. Was really enlightening and really kept pushing me forward. And so that was one of the things that, as a executive team down in Dallas, we continued to support and push each other in directions of development. And so ended up going to get additional education. I got my master's from Georgetown University in emergency and disaster management, and really wanted to tie that education piece together, which interested me in pursuing my doctorate, of where I finished at Southern Methodist University with a doctorate in education. And so, you know, you continue to push yourself and do different things. And so the next, you know, sensible, you know, course of a career was to try to find an opportunity to be a fire chief. And I'm very intentional, and I wanted to find somewhere that was a good fit, where I had the skill set, where somewhere that, you know, I would have that passion and fire. And so that's pretty much how I applied here and went through the process and really enjoyed the city as I, you know, got to know it.
So if we're not calling you Chief McKinley, we need to call you Dr. McKinley.
I prefer right? Frank, so. Okay.
Is it rare among the ranks of fire chiefs to also have PhDs? That seems, to me, I don't know too many.
It's actually quite a few. You'd be surprised. And I have an EDD, a doctorate in education, and you do see several that have PhDs in different fields of study, but I'm real passionate about education because I think it's applicable to, you know, multiple industries and it really ties things together. And it's a tremendous component in any fire department because, again, that's how our recruits learn. That's how we continue to develop. And so I feel that it's a very critical piece into being successful in incorporating change.
So that's going to lead me to my first question about you taking over in Cincinnati, but I want to know, it sounds like this is the first time you have not lived or worked in Texas or the Dallas area. Is that correct?
Yes. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that originally, well, I think I did, Biloxi, Mississippi, but, you know, little summer jobs outside of that, and they didn't last long. So Texas is the only place that I've worked in the capacity of a firefighter in the fire service.
Was that a big mental leap for you to consider a job outside of Texas to come to Ohio?
Not really. Again, it's one of those where you do your research and you try to find out as much as you can. You make phone calls. You use the internet. And you know, I found out a lot of different things, the size of the department, how many members, you know, a lot about the diversity and the makeup and some of the challenges that exist. I had opportunity to look at some of the previous budgets and things of that nature. And so when you start looking at those different aspects and, you know, does administration, you know, really invest into the fire department? You know, when you look at the budgets and the different things and you try to find strategies and ways. And after building a network and not just in Dallas, in other cities, you know, different things, you get feedback from different, you know, members throughout in the fire service throughout the country. And so it's one of those where you really, really research. And then it gives you more confidence because you're more knowledgeable. You kind of have an idea of what you're entering into.
Tell me a little bit about you have just started. Have you been given what I would call a honeymoon period by the city? Some, you talked about the budget and the needs of the department. Have they in the first few months been supportive of what you've wanted to do? Or have you had a time to put together like a 100-day plan? I know just from experience, you only get one honeymoon phase, right? Where you're new and everybody wants to be supportive. Have you leveraged that in any way? Have you been?
You're still in the honeymoon phase, right?
I would hope so. Me? No, 6 years later? No, I'm done with that phase. How has been the first 100 days?
It's been very interesting. I've had an opportunity to visit all firehouses, some other work locations. I've met with several of the department directors, and it's a lot of things that, you know, it was important for me to understand, both internally and externally. You know, how does the fire department fit into the city? You know, there's this pot of money and we have to understand how it's distributed. And I'm sure that the fire department isn't the only department that has challenges or has needs and wants. And so, you know, talking to some of these department directors and, you know, understanding, you know, how some of the capital spending and purchasing and, you know, the appetite for different types of, you know, purchasing methods and things like that. And so that tour gave me a better insight on being able to develop a strategy. And it continues to involve some deep, you know, down digging to understand how can we ensure that, you know, the department isn't a burden on the rest of the city. They have needs. They have streets. They have homelessness solutions to address and things like that. And so, you know, we want to be able to advocate for other departments and help them be successful as opposed to give me, give me, give me. And we look for other opportunities to find some funding options and things like that. But internally, we just conducted a internal survey that was voluntary. And it was roughly 40 questions to really just try to understand some of the thoughts and ideas of our members. And so we used that time to, discuss that, and we wanted to be very transparent. And so when we got the results, we did a cumulative distribution of the results and shared it with the members and, you know, wanted them to see it. We had roughly, it was close to 50%. It was probably between 47 and 50% participation, which we felt real good about. And we're still continuing to drill down into it and make sense of some of the narrative pieces of it. So, That's one of the things that we've done internally. We've also, you know, tried to streamline communication with our members, with our chief officers. And so we have some things that we're going to really jump on to try to be successful at that here in the first quarter of the calendar year. So,
okay. So you had 50% participation. What would you say, what was the biggest surprise of responses that you got from people?
There's concern over the EMS system and, the increase in call run volume and, the way the workload and how it's distributed, the number of medics and things like that. And so also it was communication issues and things. I feel that, you know, a lot of times people say that, you know, individuals can be resistant to change. And a lot of times that's true, but it's because there's not, you know, good communication. Not saying that it hasn't been in the past. Historically, I don't know those things. I talked to the command staff about that, but there are certain things that me as a fire chief that I want to be able to communicate and open those lines of communication to where members feel comfortable having input into things that we change or if change is actually needed. So it's real important for me to get that input, whether it's a survey instrument, whether it's focus groups, whether it's just visiting the firehouses. I've been out and I've ridden at a few different fire locations, and I find it very interesting. I love the customer service. I love the passion. I love the professionalism that our members have. And it's incredible, you know, when you see some of the things that they have to face, the tragedy. And so we talk about the mental health component, making sure that they have the support and resources that they need to be able to support and provide services to the citizens.
You talked about the workload with the run rate increasing. How is staffing in the department, particularly with paramedics, EMTs? Is that a challenge?
Well, we're still continuing to drill down into that to get answers. And so in that line, if you look, the last time we put an ambulance in service was 2009. And that's, you know, a decade and a half, close to a decade and a half. And you can only imagine how the run volume has increased since then. And so, you know, being able to develop strategies to support that EMS system. And we have to make sure that growth is adequate and that we have the resources. I'm very familiar with some of the events that come, the Jazz Fest, that attract a lot of people to the area. And so when you have that can really burden the workload during those hours, especially the peak hours, it can be even more challenging. And so we want to make sure from a fire department standpoint that we have the ability and we're prepared to do those type of things. And so that's being evaluated now. Some may think it's as simple as, just putting more ambulances in service. And it's more challenging than that. And so when you look at other cities across the country, they have community paramedic programs, community medic programs. They have, you know, specialized teams that respond differently. And so we have to see, you know, how can we augment or supplement, you know, the current system? And it doesn't need to be a phased approach. Again, how we do what we do is extremely important, because to just go to the city and say, hey, let's, you know, put, you know, three more ambulances in. Well, now we have to, how many FTEs does that require to staff it? So those type of things we have to really drill down into. And then you have to factor in attrition and other things like injuries. So There are good formulas to use to be able to determine that, but it's just like a navigation system. It has to know where you are first to tell you how to get there. And so I think that's what we've been doing as a command staff, as some of the chief officers, is really trying to understand where we are.
And just for clarity's sake, when you say 2009, you're talking about an ambulance unit, not the actual ambulance vehicle, the age of the vehicle, or
no,
are you?
Right. No, I'm talking about an ambulance, you know, that you see responding to medical calls and putting those type of units in. And so just looking at, you know, things that we can do.
So we've had the same number of ambulance units in Cincinnati since 2009.
Correct.
Okay.
So he's coming for a little bit of context. We've written some about this. I think you guys probably be seeing some more this year from myself and one of our breaking news reporters, Cameron Knight, because it's not just the fire department. We're really talking about what's going on with the police department. They just closed a district. Like, what's really the best plan? And we're talking about still a very new administration. Aftab Puraval, our mayor's only going into now his third year. We had a new council, and everyone was kind of like getting up to speed on what was happening after a pandemic. But these issues are lingering from a while ago of like, how do we deploy resources in the city? And like, so when we're asking you these questions, we know the answers aren't there, but you're coming at such a critical time. I loved when I was looking at the short list of resumes, all of your education, because I think that's going to play such a huge part in making what are going to be huge decisions. Like, where do our citizens live? Where do things need to change? We have the same apparatus in the city other than closing a police district that we have had for decades and decades. The city has changed, but how we deploy all of the services has pretty much remained the same. And I see some changes coming just because that's just where we're at in the city. So anyway, so some context there. It's not just like, oh, the fire department. It's like the whole city's kind of looking at this bigger picture of things.
Right. And that's important, and especially when you look at the type of calls and, you know, the mental health calls and some of the response models that have been assembled to try to address those calls. And so it's a lot of data. It's a lot of research. It's about understanding. We take a look. We've gone back to like 2008 and looked at some things and what has changed. And so to understand that gives us a better idea of how we need to approach those things or what it needs to look like. I mean, as a chief, I still believe that, you know, the men and women out at the firehouse where the rubber meets the road need to be a part of some of those solutions. And so there's going to be a lot of transparency. There are going to be a lot of conversations and they will understand what our challenges are and why we need to do what we need to do. If I make a decision over there around the corner about how they need to do their job, I mean, that's totally unfair. And it's easy to say, well, I've done it and, you know, we've always done it that way. But I feel that we get caught into that system. So
when you took over the opportunity, the vacancy in Cincinnati for the fire chief occurred after the prior chief was terminated due to, just to say it delicately, not the best working conditions for female members of the department. Tell me a little bit about any changes that have happened in that regard or your assessment of what needs to happen.
Well, you know, I had a somewhat of a brief understanding coming in. Obviously, I've read, you know, with the media, you know, published about, you know, what was going on with the fire department. And again, I hate to keep going back to saying, hey, assess, 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 but it's also about communication. And so to understand that, like I mentioned earlier, you know, making sure that we had a valid survey instrument where we can, you know, understand, you know, these experiences. And so I've always spoke about people enjoying their experience being out at the firehouse. And that means in any demographic group, and especially if you look at members from 0 to 5 years and, 6 to 10 years and things like that. And so when you look at those experiences, you have to understand them. And so, I'm very transparent and I want to be very consistent. And we do what we call a president's meeting. That's where the union president comes. That's where the president of CAFA, Cincinnati Association of African-American Firefighters, and Ignite Group, the women's workforce group, have them in a room, and I bring in the command staff, and we answer questions. We ask them to go solicit questions from their members, concerns, or even ideas, and we go around the table. If we have something to share with them, some of the things that we're seeing, some of the things that we want to change, We use this platform to be able to address some of those things. And we've called everybody and let them have a seat at the table. And we want to understand how we can support, women in the fire service, African-American firefighters, the union, because, again, they serve a very important role in making sure that things are going well at the firehouse and that they have a good work environment.
All right. Were there any big surprises when you took over that you just shook your head and went, wow, they do things really differently here in Cincinnati from what I'm used to?
Well, and that was one of the things. I understand that there are different practices in different locations. The budget process was a little bit different. The capital budget before the operating budget wasn't done at the same time. And some of, revenue sources for the city, how that was structured. And I dig into those type of things because, again, it's important to understand how the fire department fits into the city. We're not the only show in town. And while we're very important, we have a critical role. These other services have to be able to be supported by the budget and things like that. So I know from a fleet standpoint, the process of procuring equipment and apparatus is quite a bit different than what I've experienced before, and so being able to function in that environment, and it's just like going from one system to the next, and I have to have the ability to adjust, and so some of the things that we may do here, some people may have to adjust. And so, but the goal is to do what's best for the citizens. The goal is to do what's best for the members and, make sure that we balance that.
What would you say the biggest, if you can, top of your list need will be?
Well, we're still assessing that because there are a lot of things that, I want to understand thoroughly before we start making decisions. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to say that because, again, when we talk about, putting equipment in service, some of the services that we provide, water rescue, we want to expand to be able to have drone programs and things like that. Now, we have to be able to prioritize those things. We have a list of things that we're currently working on as far as it relates to some of the firehouses and, determining, what does expansion look like? What is improving those firehouses? And it's not just as easy as tearing a firehouse down and, building a new one because, while it's being built, where do those members and how is that community affected? And so when we look at that from a geographic standpoint and a response standpoint, there has to be a comprehensive strategy put into place so those communities aren't impacted. And so, and I know it may oftentimes sound like a lot of rhetoric, but it is real important to drill down to determine what those priorities are. And again, when they are decided, understanding, I knew it was challenges with fire equipment. When we look at fire engines and fire trucks, and you're going to wait at least three to four years to get a fire engine or fire truck. And that's challenging.
So you're not just rolling up to the fire truck lot,
right,
signing the papers,
right,
and buying,
saying,
one.
Hey,
it's like
let me
three
take
year,
two of those.
It's a 3 year process.
Yeah, 2 to 3 year.
Wow.
I'm sorry, I misspoke.
That's roughly, still long.
Yeah, it is long. And so when you do that, you don't necessarily just have to think about what do I need right now? What am I going to need in 2 to 3 years? And so it's again, you know, best practices is about reaching out to the network and saying, how would you go about doing this? Since I've been here, I've reached out to the fire chief in Indianapolis to kind of understand some of the regionally, you know, accepted practices and how they do things. I can keep continuing being a fire junkie, and I'll read Firehouse Magazine, Fire Engineering Magazine, and when I'll pick up the phone and call a chief and ask how they do things. Mm-hmm.
All right. So do you have any, Sherry, like, you know, hard-hitting departmental questions? Because I want to shift gears again.
No, go ahead. I do want to say, I mean, do we have enough manpower? Because that is something that can change budget to budget pretty quickly, as opposed to all of the other things that do take a lot of strategy. Like, you can put a fire recruit class in a budget each year. Where are we at on manpower?
Well, and that's what we're doing. That's one of the biggest, if there is a biggest deep dive, that's one of the biggest deep dive is doing a staffing study. And so, again, how we staff equipment, there are a lot of challenges when we start talking about staffing. I spoke about the injuries, things that the city has done with parental leave and other things. So the unique thing about Cincinnati Fire Department is we're the only city department that has mandatory staffing. And so it's important to understand what that looks like. And so it's not just the FTEs. When I hire an FTE, or they go to recruit school, and I won't get the return on my investment until, you know, probably about 13 to 14 months later. And so it's just about saying, where do we need to be? Again, injuries will throw a loophole when you look at vacation and holidays. I think we're roughly around 841 uniform members. Is that right? Roughly around 841. But that doesn't mean that they're all out in the field. And when you look at, you know, when injuries occur, when promotions occur, attrition, we're averaging between 40 and 45 a year in attrition. So I have RN Hall. She's our chief financial officer. She does an outstanding job of drilling down and really making sense of this. Where do we need? What is that magic number? And then we would try to staff to, you know, make sure that we have that. And, just look at, you know, some of the things and how different pieces of equipment historically have been put in the service. And if we need to make those adjustments and changes, you know, how do we successfully and collectively collaborate to get that done?
I love that you gave her a shout out. Now, I don't even know all of their names, but I know that people like her kind of make the city run. And then we have the chief sit in this chair and we talk to them about the department and department heads and who's running the streetcar. And we love to talk like the big picture. But for, you know, every one of you, there's definitely at least one of them, right, like doing all of that kind of financial work.
People that really do the work.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to shift gears now because we only have a few minutes left. Are you a Cowboys fan, and are you going to remain a Cowboys fan?
I am definitely not a Cowboys fan. I'm a Bengals fan and obviously a Bengals fan. They're in the AFC, and so I'm a New Orleans Saints fan because that was the regional team.
Okay, that's true. Yep, in Southern Tech. Now, if anyone from the Bengals is listening and has learned that you were a wide receiver and they invite you in to take a few passes from Joe Burrow, are you up for that?
Yes. I actually brought my cleat. So, I'd love to go run some routes and actually throw the ball too. So,
okay. Yeah. Well, that's good to know. I mean, if they have as many injuries next season as they did this year, they might need to. I'm just being a realist here. I mean, so have you been to the stadium?
Yes. It was an incredible experience. One of the things I love about the stadium is it's an actual stadium and not a dome. And so some of the flyovers have been incredible. I love the singing of the national anthem, and it just kind of sends chills up your spine. And so it's been real good. I love it. I love, you know, open stadiums. I wish that all stadiums were so.
What else have you been able to do to enjoy yourself since you've been in town?
I've visited some of the firehouses, and I go in my sweats, and sometimes they don't even recognize me. And
like undercover boss style? Yeah,
yes, and it's fun. I get out. I walk quite a bit. I walk, exercise down the riverfront. I've had an opportunity to visit some of the nice restaurants here in Cincinnati, and I've, I love to eat. I love to work, but I pretty much... I've been really focused on, learning the city, learning the culture. I've had an opportunity to get out to some of the different neighborhoods and visit and have some level of community involvement. I got a chance to play Santa Claus a few weeks ago, and that's been fun. And one of the things that we've done as a command staff, since the holidays, we did it on Thanksgiving, we go on a cookie run. And we take cookies to all the firehouses on Christmas Day, on Thanksgiving Day, to just, tell them how much we appreciate them. And they do a hard, and it's very difficult a lot of times, especially when you have small children or just recently getting married and you're away for 24 hours. And, and I know a lot of times they think that we're sitting at home watching football games and we're with our families, and they are our families. And so I wanted us to, start making an effort of getting out, creating our own tradition, letting our members know that we do care and we are concerned.
I did not see Santa Claus on the list of requirements when I was looking at what they were looking for, but here we are.
Well, and that's the thing. And in all honesty, I think it should be, when you have an opportunity to put a smile on a kid's face, I'll dress up as a circus clown, as a Statue of Liberty on the 4th of July, whatever it takes to, if it's a nursing facility, if it's a rec center, if it's something like that. I do think, because again, when I interviewed for the job, one of the things that I said that was very important to me was making sure that I was an ambassador to the community. And that doesn't just mean showing up. That means, putting a smile on kids' face, and, and sometimes they don't have that opportunity to talk to a Santa Claus.
So if I can say, this first time I met you in person, you seem very low-key, professional. I'm having a hard time imagining you in a Statue of Liberty costume. I can't imagine now. I believe you, but... So I imagine that takes people off guard in a good way.
Right. Well, it's a very serious position. And so I'm very, cautious about, how it comes across. But, they see me in the office leaving late at night. They see me putting out messages. It's real important to sometimes not take it, too serious.
Right.
And a lot of these things that I do, it's after hours. And, have an opportunity to do that, I'll spend my time doing it, and it should be required in the job.
All right.
Well, firefighters are very much a part of our community.
They are. Absolutely. I do have one more question that I just thought of, thinking of the differences between Ohio and Texas. I haven't heard much about it lately, but I know that the different firehouses have, in the past, maybe they still do chili cook-offs contests.
Right.
Is that true? Is that
they
happening?
Do, yes.
Are you skeptical about Ohio chili compared to the chili you had in Texas? And I'm not even talking about Cincinnati style
chili. Because you're going to ask that next. That's a whole other debate.
But are you going into that with an open mind? Because I have to think, coming from the state that everybody thinks of nationally when you think about chili, that you're probably not going to be impressed.
Well, I am impressed. Actually, my executive assistant, Jesse Short Jr., we had chili the other day for lunch, and it's something that I like.
Cincinnati style chili?
Yes.
Oh, so yeah. He's in the studio with us. So you had to indoctrinate him?
Yes.
All right, good.
Mm-hmm. Was it the first time?
No, it wasn't. I went to Skyline. I had some other chili. I've tried some different things, and I love to taste different cuisines and different foods, and I do it with an open mind, and so I'm open to it.
But what I'm really talking about is...
He didn't say he loved it. He said he was open to it.
It's a little early.
It took me a long time.
I'm talking about, not Cincinnati style chili, but like firehouse chili. I got to imagine that there's no better place than Texas to get firehouse chili.
Oh, they have some pretty impressive cooks here.
Okay. So, all right. You're not just being diplomatic.
No, there's a lot of pride in this. I know this.
Right. I went to,
there's a lot of pride.
I got invited to dinner at the Threes, and they really laid it out, and I was extremely impressed. And so Firehouse is a great place to eat, so it really is.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to let you get back to your new job, newish job. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Learned a lot.
The budget process is just starting, Burr. We'll talk to you a lot during that.
Yeah, you're friends with Sherry now, but just wait. When she sinks her teeth into that budget story, she's going to be relentless.
I know. Well, there's good budget news this year. I don't know if you heard. They sold the railroad.
Oh, do you think I didn't hear that? I think everybody knows that. So, well, we thank you again, Chief.
Well, thank you very much. And if it's ever anything that I could do for you all, if y'all want to tour the Chief's office, feel free.
All right. We'll take you up on that.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
It was very nice of the new chief to come and join us. I think it's very hard, like coming in. I do think that good leaders do come in and assess. I think, I'm not just saying this because you're my boss. I think that you did that. You can't just come in and say, I have all the answers and this is what it is. You do have to learn, especially in a city of 52 neighborhoods. Cincinnati is very unique in that, in the firehouses to each of the 52 neighborhoods are unique unto themselves. And I don't think you can just come in and be like, I have all the answers. You really do have to take the time to get to know the landscape here and the people. And so I think that this really is just, you know, the beginning of things, even though he's 3 months in, we're asking some questions he doesn't have answers to yet, but a good leader would not necessarily have the answers.
No, very much still in assess mode. And I think that's refreshing to hear. You definitely don't want to come into a job like that, like a wrecking ball, without taking time to understand how the department works, how the city works. One of the things I like about the format of this podcast is, you know, it's, you know, we did the stories, obviously, that there was a search and here are the candidates and here's the person who was selected and here's his credentials. And, but we really got to hear him in a very relaxed setting, just talk about his philosophy. We learned a little bit about him personally. And I think that's important for us as people who live in this community to remind ourselves that they're not, they are defined by much more than their role in the city, that they are human beings and they have experiences. And he's got some interesting experiences. I think he was pretty humble when he said that there's, you know, other fire chiefs that have taken the time to get a doctorate in education. Not many. So there's a lot of depth to him that I think came out in our discussion with him that I hope our listeners appreciated.
So, all right. Well, we have taken a break. You did mention that. It's been, I feel like, a long break.
We haven't had a podcast all year.
And that.
Those jokes never get old with me.
I did a lot of the holiday things. I think after the last podcast, I went to the zoo. We did the Holidays of Lights. I went to the holiday lunch at Jeff Ruby's. I had a very good holiday. Did not take my vacation in a very thoughtful way last year. Kind of saved it up till the end, but I had fun with my family. But I have to say, a highlight of my vacation was on Christmas Day. I went to St. William's Parish for Christmas Day Mass. And it was such a, like, that's not my home parish. I live in Delhi. It was such a reminder of what beautiful churches that we have here in Cincinnati. And I have, and this is so City Hall of me, have been to St. William's Church for voting things, like to talk to voters.
Yeah,
and like,
yeah.
One time I like worked at the polls there and everything. And so I've been to that church before. I know it's beautiful, but to be there on Christmas Day for Mass. It was a good time to think about the year behind me and the year ahead. But just this city has just so many beautiful churches. And we're writing about, you know, about how some of these churches are closing and some of the schools are closing. But we should cherish what we do have here.
You know, it sounds cliche to say they don't build them like that anymore, but we don't build churches like that anymore.
I mean, how could they? I literally was sitting there thinking, how could they?
Yeah, can you imagine? And you're right, Cincinnati is particularly on the west side. That's, I think, one of the things we take for granted living in what many call like a first-generation American city, that you do have this historic architecture, not just in churches, but, you know, all over the city. Well, that's pretty cool. You had an opportunity to take something like that in. I didn't have anything that powerful as far as, you know, anything I did over the holidays. Although one of the things Lauren and I did was we were talking about holiday movies, and in her mind, the classic, I'll call it a chick flick. I hope okay, I don't
go,
get hate
go
for
ahead,
that.
Go ahead.
Movie Love Actually.
I love that movie.
I had never seen it. And she's like, what? You've never seen Love Actually? And
I stunned myself.
And I was like, is that even a holiday movie? A Christmas? And she's like, well, yeah. And I'm like, okay. And I was feeling a little inadequate. And I'm like, well, I consider like A Christmas Story. And she's like, well, I've never seen that. I'm like, what? You've never seen A Christmas Story? So I made her sit down and watch A Christmas Story, which she enjoyed. And she made me sit down and watch Love Actually, which I kind of enjoyed. I got to admit, by the end, I was caught up in it and maybe a little emotional.
I had a good conversation about Love Actually with somebody over the break. And a lot has been said about that movie because there's a lot of things in it that are not politically correct in today's world.
Right, yeah.
So fine, but that's not what that's been said and written to death.
There's a lot of movies
when
you can
I
say that about,
said
though.
That was one of my favorite movies. The person I was talking to is like, I don't really like that movie. It's so dismal. Like, everyone's unhappy, like, for most of the movie. And I was like, that actually is why I like it, because it has a happy ending for all of the different characters. And yes, that person was right, that everyone's unhappy, like, throughout a lot of it. But then everyone gets this happy ending, and that's what I liked about it. So anyway.
Well, I knew so little about it that I didn't even realize it was, like, the showcase of its era for British actors, British filmmaking. And so that part was interesting too.
So you know, as much has been written and said about that.
Watching
movie.
Hugh Grant.
And now
watching
you?
Hugh Grant before the fall, you know, before his but anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like I did my part though and added, you know, to the cult following of A Christmas Story.
I didn't know
at least one other person.
Know anyone who hadn't seen it. We did binge watch The Crown. The last season, we love The Crown.
Did you?
We do. I actually like royal history.
Yeah.
And so we binge watched the end of The Crown.
All right.
Sad to see that series go.
Sadly, the
holidays. See, I do watch some TV.
Sadly, the holidays are behind us. We're off and running in a new year. And so I'm pretty excited. I don't want
to
tip our hands, but we got some pretty exciting guests on the radar for the podcast. So hopefully you guys will hang with us, stay tuned, and we'll see you next week.
Sounds good.
All right.